No point in fearing what we cannot control, right? Or can we? I guess that's what it's about tonight, whether or not we can control, ultimately, the destiny of the human race. We'll find out. We'll also ask about the mystery of life and, of course, death. That's coming up. Well, the greatest mystery of all is what happens to us, I guess, after we physically pass away. And I wonder if these experiences, Graham, have told you anything about all of that, the great mystery of life and death.
Oh, yes, certainly. The work that I've done with ayahuasca in the Amazon, with Ibogaine from Africa, has touched very often on that matter. I have encountered directly the spirit of my deceased father in my ayahuasca journeys. He has communicated with me, and not only with me, but with my wife, Santa, who's also undertaken many of these journeys with me, and communicated in such a way that I am left in no doubt whatsoever that he his consciousness did survive death. If I go back in my own life story, I can say that I'm now 57 years old. In my teens and my 20s, I regarded myself as an absolute atheist. I didn't believe that there was any meaning or transcendental purpose to life. If somebody said to me, "Do you think that life goes on after death?" I would simply have laughed and regarded it as a complete joke. But experiences and lessons began to come to me during my 30s and 40s before I had ever experienced ayahuasca. The first step that I started to make on this journey was the research and the work that I needed to do for my earlier books concerning ancient civilizations, and particularly concerning ancient Egypt. You know, the ancient Egyptians devoted their best minds for more than 3,000 years to the consideration of one mystery only, and that is the mystery of what happens to us when we die.
That's right.
It's precisely the issue that our society today ignores entirely and pretends does not exist. We are such amateurs in the exploration of these mysteries by comparison with the ancient Egyptians and by comparison with any practicing shaman in the Amazon today. Now, if you go into the ancient Egyptian sacred texts, for example, the famous Books of the Dead, or the pyramid texts or the so-called coffin texts, so-called because they were written inside coffins in which the dead were mummified, you will find a complete map of the afterlife realm. And actually, I have a chapter on ancient Egypt in my book Supernatural and on their ideas about the afterlife realm. And I'm certain that the ancient Egyptian priests used altered states of consciousness, deliberately induced them in order to map out and in a thoroughly systematic manner explore and explain what happens to us after we die. It's very interesting that they indicate that we make a journey after our death, that when the soul, that when the material body dies or the soul leaves the body, it then undertakes a journey through a strange parallel universe that the ancient Egyptians called the Duat, might be roughly translated as the underworld or the netherworld or the afterworld. And in this journey, we are confronted with the consequences of everything that we have done and failed to do in this material life.
That's terrifying.
Extremely terrifying. You see, those scientists who say that we have afterlife beliefs simply to comfort ourselves and that, of course, it's all nonsense really have no idea what they're talking about. If you go into cultures that really examine the mystery of the afterlife, you'll find that the beliefs are not comforting at all and that we are tested and weighed up and measured on what we did or did not do with our lives. And every negative action, every cruel thought, every vicious word that we have spoken will come back to us during the afterlife journey in the form of monsters demons to punish us, to terrify us, to confront us. We have to confront the consequences of our own actions. It was seen as a journey through a strange underworld of corridors and passageways, with a series of gates through which one must pass. And at each of those gates, one was tested, and eventually one comes into what was called the Hall of Maat. Now, Maat was the goddess of truth and justice. Her symbol was the feather. And there, symbolically, our heart is weighed in the scales against the feather of Maat, the feather of truth, the feather of harmony, the feather of cosmic justice. And if our hearts are heavy with sin, and not only with sin, but with the failure to take advantage of the incredible gift that we have been given to be born in a human body, then our hearts will outweigh the feather, and then we must confront a being that the ancient Egyptians called Amit, the eater of the dead, and it becomes possible through the consequences of our own choices and actions that we might face eternal annihilation, never to be reborn, never to come back. But if we've lived right, if we've used this gift of life properly, if we've lived it to the full, if we've experienced and given love, most importantly of all, if we have loved others, and that means giving. Love is not about taking, it's about giving. Then we pass the test in this Hall of Maat, which was also called the Judgment Hall of Osiris, move on, perhaps into another incarnation in this world, to learn more lessons, to grow, to develop further, to rectify past mistakes. And ultimately, the vision of the ancient Egyptians was that we would be reborn as a star in the sky.
So there is a kind of a parallel to what we traditionally think of as heaven and hell. Yes,
there's no doubt that these ideas of heaven and hell that are encountered in Christianity and Islam, for example, have their origins in the ancient Egyptian way of thinking. It's just that the ancient Egyptian approach to it was so much more sophisticated, and I would suggest based on direct experiences undergone by the priests of ancient Egypt in altered states of consciousness, rather than simply in a body of lore passed down without experience from generation to generation, which is what we have today.
And reincarnation.
Reincarnation is a very strong, systematic part of the ancient Egyptian view. Of course, it's a systematic, very strong part of the ancient religions of India as well, that we come back into physical incarnation again and again and again. And why do we come back? We come back because life is a school, just as I said earlier, that ayahuasca in the Amazon is a school to teach us. And that if we don't learn the lessons it has to teach, the next time we drink ayahuasca, it will confront us with those lessons again. So also with the broader picture of life. We come back into this life in order to learn those lessons. And only when we've learned them and mastered them and done right and thought right and lived our lives to the full without harming others, without adding to the stock of misery in the world, only then do we move on to the next level.
And the traditional concept of God?
The traditional concept of God, I think, and again, I'm drawing on my own experiences in altered states of consciousness here rather than on the teachings of any church. I think that the traditional concept of God is largely a human invention. I think it's something that we created. We projected our own idea of how society should be ruled over by a single, all-powerful, omnipotent individual, and we projected that out into the supernatural realm. But I do not think that that's actually how it is. I think it's much more complicated than that. I think there are enormous numbers of beings and entities and intelligences out there, some deeply concerned with the human race, some loving and caring for and nurturing the human race, but some also that are antagonistic.
All right, listen, Graham. I've got to go to the phones. A million people want to talk to you, so let's keep it short, everybody, if we can. And here it comes, Graham. I think it's Bob in Washington, Pennsylvania. You're on the air with Graham Hancock.
Thank you, Mr. Bell, for doing the show, Mr. Hancock. I just wanted to say that I've experienced with psilocybin mushrooms. And the commonality, Mr. Bell, he is absolutely correct. I have met the Earth Goddess, was what I had called it, several times. And I just wanted to thank you very much for doing the show and keep up the good work.
Thank you for that comment. It's much, much appreciated and helps to add to our knowledge and understanding of these mysteries.
It does, and it seems to me that the commonality screams out for science. And,
yes.
And science just walks away from this one, apparently.
Walks away from it again and again and again because it confronts and affronts the basic principles of science, that which are that everything can be explained in simplistic, materialistic, and mechanical terms. Science can continue to control our lives if everything is material. But the moment that consciousness comes to the issue and that there is a supernatural realm surrounding us, then science must become more humble and must learn from the very people it despises, such as the shamans of tribal and hunter-gatherer societies.
Okay. Kurt in Two Harbors, Minnesota. You're on with Graham Hancock. Hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call, Art.
Sure.
I would like to ask Mr. Hancock, why exactly is absinthe criminalized in the United States, yet it's freely available for purchase over in other countries?
Well, I mean, this is true not only of absinthe, the drink, which does have undoubtedly mind-altering qualities. But it's true of many, many other substances as well. I've been talking about ayahuasca. Ayahuasca is totally legal, and indeed its use is protected under laws of religious freedom throughout Peru and Brazil and Ecuador and other countries of South America surrounding the Amazon basin, whereas in the United States and Britain, it's completely illegal, and DMT is completely illegal, and one is not allowed to consume these substances. There's a lot of inconsistencies between the ways that different countries come to conclusions about what is legal and what is not. My own view, controversial though it may be, is that governments have no right to rule and tell us what we may or may not put inside our own bodies as adults. We alone are responsible for that. As long as we do not get into other people's faces, as long as we do not do harm to others, the moment we start doing harm to others, then governments may have a role to prevent us from doing so. But if we do no harm to others, then I don't think the government has any business, whether it's absinthe or anything else, in ruling that we may or may not put it into our own bodies. We are adults. We have the right to make decisions about our own bodies. And it's an absurd transgression of human liberty that governments take it upon themselves to tell us what we may or may not put into our bodies. And in fact, by convincing us that they have a right to tell us to do that, they are opening the door to all kinds of other infringements of our liberties. And we are seeing those infringements of our liberties spreading out all around the world today. Far from becoming a free society, our societies in the West are becoming increasingly unfree, and I think this campaign to control what we do or do not put into our bodies are at the heart of this transgression of liberty that is now underway.
Well, surely you can understand, as I can, Graham, that there are certain substances that are addictive and damaging. And those you can understand perhaps being, you know, in the purity of the argument, I guess you could argue for cocaine or heroin or whatever you wish, but really you can come to an understanding of why they've been legislated against.
Yeah, but you see, the problem is that the legislation actually doesn't work. If we wish to prevent people from taking harmful substances, then making those substances criminal and illegal and ruining people's lives and putting them in prison for up to 30 years for taking them, that's not the way to go. Look, we have a very clear example of this, which is the issue of smoking tobacco. Smoking tobacco is not illegal in our societies, but there has been a very effective and efficient information campaign which has persuaded adults that it is not in their interest to smoke tobacco. And as a result, we can look at the statistics. Over the last 25 years, there's been a vast reduction in the smoking of tobacco. This has happened without any criminal sanctions whatsoever. On the other hand, if you take substances like heroin and cocaine, against which there are massive punitive criminal sanctions, do we see a reduction in the use of those substances in our society? No, we don't.
What about alcohol?
Let me just finish on that. We don't see any reduction, and this suggests to me that our governments, as in so many other areas, are not being honest with us. Mm. They are lying to us about the reasons why all of these substances are illegal. It is really about control of the state over individuals that's going on here. A precedent is being set where the state, we ourselves acquiesce and stand back and allow the state to intervene in this most intimate area of our lives, what we choose to do as adults. And once we allow that, then we're prepared to allow the state all other kinds of transgression of our liberties as well.
Alcohol.
Yes, well, there's another extremely damaging drug, which is extremely dangerous to human health, which is, of course, completely legal in our societies. Much more dangerous to human health than psilocybin mushrooms, for example.
Oh, indeed.
Vastly more dangerous. What about the motor car? What about the tens of thousands of people who are killed every year on the roads? What about painkillers like paracetamol, which are entirely legal and yet are responsible for thousands of deaths every year? Take it further. What about what about knives? I mean, people get killed by knives. What about fires? Why aren't fires illegal?
But if you just stay in the realm of drugs, Graham, alcohol
is... Yeah, but what I'm saying is that the principle that something should be made illegal because it is harmful to our health, this is actually not the real reason why drugs are being made illegal, because if it was, then other substances that are harmful to our health would be made illegal. We would not be allowed to drive in motor cars because those are harmful to our health. So the real reason is something else. It's about control. It's about certain individuals in our society who have controlling mentalities and who gravitate towards government. And they seek all kinds of excuses and reasons to control us. And that, I'm convinced, is what the war on drugs is really all about. It's certainly failed in its own objectives. It has not cut down the consumption of heroin and cocaine. It has caused a great deal of misery. If we really want adults to stop taking heroin and cocaine, then we need to provide them with information that is honest, that they believe, that is not corrupted and full of lies.
That's a very good point. Lied to once, then a person feels they're lied to each time. It's Robert in Texarkana. You're on with Graham.
Hey, Art Bell.
Hi.
All right, I got a question here. You guys were saying that in 2012 that we're going to be hit with a meteorite that might take us out, right?
A comet. I'm saying it's possible. I'm saying this is one possible interpretation of the ancient myths and traditions of the Mayan calendar, that there was a horrendous planetary cataclysm 12,500 years ago, and that it may be about to come back, and that a comet may be the agency involved.
Okay, now, we do have telescopes that... Now, I'm not familiar with all I don't even know what I'm talking about now.
Well, it's quite all right, sir. We kind of covered that. In other words, we
did cover that these objects approach the Earth very frequently without being seen by our leading astronomers, despite the investment of billions of dollars in astronomical technology.
Actually, the people that find these likely to hit Earth-type objects are the amateurs more frequently than the large telescopes. They're not looking for these things.
They're not looking for these things. No, I mean there is a study of near Earth asteroids and of objects that might collide with the Earth, but it's woefully underfunded. It's one of the areas where our governments really do have their eye off the ball right now. Much more work should be done on making us alert to this danger. Instead of hating and fearing our fellow human beings, we should look at these massive objects, sometimes 10 or 20 miles wide, that are hurtling through space at tens of thousands of miles an hour, each one of which is capable of sterilizing this planet of all life in an instant.
And capable of doing it with no warning to us whatsoever. Graham Hancock is my guest. His book is Supernatural. Good morning, everybody. This really has been quite the ride. My guest is Graham Hancock, and at this juncture, you definitely want to know his book, Supernatural, Meetings with the Ancient Teachers of Mankind. If you if you've been sort of lit up by what you've heard this morning, I would imagine you'd want to make the trip to Amazon and get that one on the way. Speaking of on the way, we'll be right back. So perhaps the real message has been there all the time, encoded within us and unlocked with something like DMT. Graham, welcome back. It's quite a journey you've made from the beginning of your career to what you're talking about tonight. Quite a journey, huh?
Yeah, it has been a journey, and I must say I do feel very, very, very lucky. I feel blessed. I feel privileged that I've had the opportunity to lead my life this way. I'm grateful to my readers for helping me to do it, because if people didn't buy my books, I wouldn't be able to fund my research and my journeys and my experiments and my adventures. I feel like a lucky man, a fortunate man, and it has been a process of evolution. You know, I started out as a journalist. I was the East Africa correspondent of The Economist back in the 70s and early 80s. I was totally concerned with current affairs, with wars and politics, mm-hmm. and famine and economics. And really the journey began with coming across in Ethiopia, which was on my beat as a journalist, a tradition that country, that Ethiopia, possessed the lost Ark of the Covenant. Finding myself in front of the gates of a mysterious chapel in the grounds of a great cathedral in the Ethiopian city of Aksum, a very remote city, where I met a monk who claimed to be the guardian of the Ark. And this really was the beginning of the whole journey into ancient mysteries for me, and it turned my life away from this prior focus on current affairs and journalism and into an in-depth inquiry into the mysteries of the past. And I wrote a book called The Sign and the Seal, A Quest for the Lost Ark of the Covenant. And from there, I went on to explore the mysteries of lost civilizations, to try to argue and present the evidence that there might have been a huge forgotten episode in human history. And finally, now in my mid to late 50s, I find myself exploring the mysteries of consciousness. And I find myself, because my ethic has always been that I must experience what I'm writing about, I find myself working with consciousness-altering plants such as ayahuasca, such as DMT, to learn about the mysteries of consciousness. And I hope in some way I've been of service, I've been useful, I've been helpful in helping other people in their own inquiries and adventures.
Graham, having made the journey that you've made, you obviously, and with the understanding you now have, how much optimism do you have that the consciousness transition that's going to be needed can occur?
I actually have great optimism.
Really?
And my optimism has been increased by my travels in the United States on this lecture tour, because I do keep on meeting people whose minds are full of questions, who are no longer willing to accept the lies and the deceitful disinformation campaigns that are foisted upon them by their governments, who want to reach out in love and care for fellow human beings rather than to beat those human beings down and force them into a particular narrow way of life. I think that America is full of good and decent people who care. Of course, this is a huge country. There are many, many millions of people who are with the forces of control and darkness, but there are equally many millions who are not and who are against it. So I think we're at a turning point. I think we're at a crossroads. But I do believe that a transformation of consciousness is possible and is on the way. And, these things begin in a small way. At first, you don't see the signs of it. It seems hopeless for each of us as an individual. We feel hopeless. How can we change the world when so many huge dark forces are ranged against us? But if each and every one of us tries in a small way, in our own local community, in our own families, in our relationships with others, in the way that we approach the world to make changes, and I see evidence that huge numbers of people are trying to do that sincerely and decently and honestly, then it could have a cumulative effect that could be very dramatic, and critical mass for this change could be reached much earlier than we think. So, you know, the ancient Maya may may be right with the notion that, it's not so much an end of the world, but an end of a particular age of the world, and that a new age may indeed be just around the corner. Yes, I do remain optimistic.
Excellent. Donovan, I think it is, in Beaumont, Texas. You're on with Graham.
Yes, it is, and it's a pleasure to talk with both of y'all.
Thank you.
I had recently read the book Supernatural and really liked it. It was great. But I was kind of curious about, I know I've listened to you quite often, Mr. Hancock, on Coast to Coast, and you talk a lot about the ayahuasca, but I didn't really see a lot of that in your book, and I was wondering, are you going to have another book that'll talk about your experiences more, or do you...
Well, I have one major chapter on my ayahuasca experiences in the book. I didn't want to talk too much about my personal experiences. You know, sometimes if you go on endlessly about your own visions and experiences, it can become boring to others. What I wanted to do was to drop hints and provide the information that would show people that this is an interesting area for them to inquire into themselves. And since I finished writing the book, I have to add that I've continued drinking ayahuasca. I now travel down to Brazil every year to drink ayahuasca. I'm quite certain that I will go on drinking ayahuasca for the rest of my life on this planet, at least 5 times a year. It's wrought such wonderful and positive changes in my life that I never wish to be without it again. And that's a choice that I'm making as a free adult in this world.
How much flack have you taken?
I've taken an awful lot of flack. I do find people get very upset. Some people get very upset and very angry and accuse me of advocating and promoting drugs. And I want to emphasize that's not what I'm doing. What I'm advocating and promoting is adult responsibility over our own lives and the choices that we make about our own bodies and consciousness. I've been attacked by academics with virtually every book I've written, and that is true of Supernatural as well. There is among scientists the view that they own and possess all knowledge, and that their way of doing things is the only way of doing things. So how dare this writer step forth and say that there might be another way? And I've got used to this over the years. It goes with the territory. If you write books that go against the prevailing order and the prevailing ideas of society, then you are going to be attacked. In former ages, people who questioned the status quo were actually killed. In our present age, more often they destroy your reputation and they make it impossible for you to function. And I faced a lot of that over the years. Sometimes it's been very tough. Sometimes it's been very difficult. But I've never felt that I should stop doing what I'm doing.
Good for you. Mike in Cleveland, Ohio. You're on with Graham Hancock. Hi.
Good evening, Art and Graham.
Hi.
Art, someone needs to suggest to Major Ed Gaines that remote viewing the DMT molecule or the pineal gland may allow a repeatable contact with that ET mind he's seeking. And Graham, a previous guest on Coast to Coast, Todd Murphy, has a product, Shakti Technologies, that has one putting 8 magnets on one's head via a hat. The software program causes a rotating magnetic field effect that he says 80% of everyone who tries the device has an out-of-body, near-death experience, contact with deceased and alien realms.
Yeah, I absolutely believe that. Magnetism is an extremely effective way to alter consciousness, and altered states of consciousness are the key to access to these supernatural realms.
And in fact, Graham, I think some scientists have found a certain area of the brain when stimulated electrically does also produce these experiences.
Well, yes. I mean, and the mistake that those scientists make is that they then suggest that the experience is somehow being manufactured in the brain.
That's right.
We would expect to see brain activity accompanying any experience. But that does not mean that the brain activity is causing the experience. It's just because our scientists have a prejudice against things that they cannot actually weigh, measure, and count. When such experiences that can't be weighed, measured, and counted in the conventional sense occur, scientists want to tell us that those experiences aren't real and are being made up or generated in the brain, and they show us brain activity, and they say, there, that's the proof that the brain is making this up. But no, it's not. All the brain is doing is what the brain always does. It's active when we have experiences.
All right. Carl in West Allis, Wisconsin.
Hi, gentlemen. I have a quick comment directed to both of you.
Sure.
Art, you earlier you'd mentioned something about wondering if we're alone in the universe. Perhaps the aliens, when we try to contact them, have caller ID. And it also, I can see their concern about what we're doing to the planet. It just brings to mind a book by Isaac Asimov, the first book of the Foundation Trilogy. And the planet Tranter comes to mind. I don't know if you're familiar with it. But my question is, to Graham, is it possible that some of this damage done 12,000 and a half years ago could have been directed by an intelligence?
Yes, I dare say it is. In fact, that's what all the ancient myths suggest. They suggest that former civilization incurred the wrath of the gods, incurred the wrath of the spirit world by its behavior. I don't rule that out at all. And in fact, that's my concern with our society today, that unless we take control of our own destinies and stop our governments leading us headlong over the abyss, that we will once again lose the mandate of heaven, once again incur the anger of the gods.
Well, you can't rule that out. This would be a first-time caller. Ben in Tucson, Arizona. You're on with Graham Hancock. Good morning.
Good morning, Art. Good morning, Graham.
Hi.
Hi. I'm an anthropologist at the University of Arizona, and I have to say a huge fan of Heaven's Mirror.
Thank you.
My question, though, has to do with the Dropa Stones. Are you familiar with these?
No, I'm not familiar with the Dropa Stones. Tell me about them.
The Dropa Stones were found in Asia in the 1930s, and they depicted a story of beings coming from the sky that crash-landed in Asia, and the story was written down by the people of the Han, and these people weren't able to rebuild their aircraft, and so they couldn't return to their planet. Mm-hmm. My question is, do you think it's possible that we had paleo contact before the Ice Age ended? And is that a belief that you hold?
Yeah, I do think we had paleo contact. I'm just not certain that contact was with beings from other planets in this physical universe. When we have these contacts, we shouldn't necessarily jump to the conclusion that that's what involved. It could be much more interesting to speculate that the contact is rather with beings from other dimensions, rather than from other locations in this dimension. We shouldn't prejudge the issue. Both are possible.
Do you believe that these beings are spiritual beings who are trying to teach us something now?
I think that the supernatural realm contains both good and evil. It contains wise and loving entities and teachers who have the health and welfare of the human race very much to heart. But there are also dark and evil forces out there which also contact humanity and operate in the human sphere, and ultimately the choice is up to us. I think that's what free will really means, that we human beings must choose between the darkness and the light, just as we must choose between the darkness and the light in this physical and material realm. So also we must choose between the darkness and the light in the supernatural realm.
Mm-hmm.
And those choices are the choices that we must make as free and independent adults.
All right, Carol in Columbia, Mississippi, you're on with Graham.
Hi, Art. First, it's so great. It's a great pleasure to have you back tonight. I really appreciate it. And I have a question for Graham.
Sure.
I lost everything I had in Hurricane Katrina. I'm an evacuee, and that's really the only good thing that came out of Katrina was because I started listening to Coast, and it's been a great joy in my life. And my question is, I don't really know if you covered this. I didn't really understand, but does he feel that global warming and the dire predictions for coastal flooding is related to the 2012 return of the comet fragments, or is that something more man-made? Or
I think that that the issue of global warming and of rising sea levels today is actually a very, very complicated issue indeed. And I have no doubt that that human behavior is part of the story, but I don't think it's the whole story. There have been periods of radical warming of the planet before, when there were no human beings on the planet. And I think it's much too simplistic an argument that's being put to us at the moment about this.
Surely there is no denying the change, no matter what.
There's no denying the change. It's a huge change. I remember as a child in England, we used to see snow every winter, deep snow, up to my knees in snow. And now we never see snow in England at all. I mean, it just doesn't fall. So definitely within the short span of a single human lifetime, the climate has changed enormously. Definitely sea level is rising again. There's no doubt that people who live within 2 or 3 feet of the sea are going to be finding their feet underwater within a few years from now.
Okay. Perhaps finally from Sedona, Arizona comes Tobias. Hi, Tobias.
Hi.
Hi.
I wanted to just confirm the commonality you're talking about.
There you go again.
I did some psychedelics 25 years ago in my life, but I really had no more interest in that until a year ago, and I ended up in the Amazon through strange circumstances or coincidences, as George calls them, and participated in 5 ceremonies. And in the first ceremony we did, ayahuasca did come as a green goddess with copper-colored hair, and I had purposely not wanted to research or find out anything ahead of time.
Right, good.
Not reading anyone else's experiences, just to have a clean experience of the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was, I just wanted to confirm that as well. And then I wanted to ask you about a life review. Daniel Brinkley talks about life reviews, and we have someone passing on in our family, and we've been reading more of his stuff. But anyway, during the ceremonies as well, that seemed to come up. It came up for me personally, sort of a mini life review.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, and also about diet. I wondered if you could speak towards how important the diet is, because we eat such polluted foods in the West.
Yes, we do. And diet is an important part of the ayahuasca experience, and it is important to avoid certain foods prior to drinking ayahuasca. As to the issue of the life review, this, again, is one of those astonishing universalities about ayahuasca, is that everyone who drinks ayahuasca, and this has happened to me many times, at a certain point during the night, after the intense visionary phase has passed, usually, will undergo a life review, will see pictures and events and stories from their life going right back to their childhood, and will get the opportunity to review their own behavior during those circumstances. And I believe that we're given this opportunity so that we have the chance, should we choose to do so, to change our behavior. And although it's extremely difficult to change our behavior, once we've seen how we behaved with absolute clarity and truth, and that's what happens in a life review, with no opportunity to hide behind illusions or pretenses, then we are strongly motivated to change ourselves for the better.
Graham, that's it. My friend,
it's been great to talk to you.
It has been wonderful to speak with you. Graham, thank you so very much. What a wild ride. Have a great night and have a great tour, my friend.
Thank you. Lovely to talk to you again, Art. Hope to see you soon.
Good night, Graham. Well. Ladies and gentlemen, that's it for tonight. The voice you hear behind me is that of an angel indeed. From the high desert and the great American Southwest, I'm Art Bell. Till next time, take care.